My father came from Chad. My mother, she's Jordanian. Imagine, my father African, my mother Jordanian, I'm Palestinian. From the old city of Jerusalem.
I am a daughter of immigrants from Ethiopia. That was also tough to be in a country full of white people and then black Jews coming.
I came to Israel from Eritrea. In Eritrea, they have many, many problems. I asked from the government of Israel to protect myself.
Africans have a long and rich history in the Holy Land. Over the centuries, pilgrims have settled in the shadows of churches, mosques, and synagogues. African descendants of ancient Israelites sent into exile millennia ago have come back home to the modern Jewish state of Israel. And most recently, people have come in search of sanctuary and a better life. I'm Paul Bachbinger from Uganda, and over the next hour here on the BBC, I'll be spending time with people from three different communities to try to explore their lives and experiences as Africans in the Holy Land. I start my journey in the coastal city of Tel Aviv. It's home to most of the 56,000 Africans who've arrived in Israel in the past 6 years or so. Most are from Eritrea and Sudan, seeking asylum from human rights atrocities in Eritrea and war in the Darfur region of Sudan. But Israel has granted refugee status to only a handful and says the rest are illegal economic migrants. Down a back street, in a former industrial workshop now used as a center for Eritrean women and their children, I meet Zabib Sultan. Like many others, she navigated a perilous journey across the Sinai Desert to get to Israel, before Israeli authorities cracked down on this route in 2012 by erecting a fence across the border with Egypt.
It was dark, 10 at night, when we arrived to Sinai. We found like many soldiers. I don't know if they're soldiers or it was very dark, but they had guns. They immediately start chaining people together. In the morning when I woke up, I found like many people sleeping next to me, very skinny, they can't stand, they pee there, very stinky. I cried a lot. There were four women who have stayed more than 5 months in that place. One day when I was sleeping there, they took them outside and they raped them. And one of them said, it's too much, kill me, I don't want to do this. And they were suffering a lot there, and I haven't seen them in Israel. I don't know what happened. Most probably they died there.
So how did you survive that?
I don't know, with the help of God. I was lucky, and our parents pay the money, like $2,400.
How did they know where your family was?
They have a phone. They gave us a phone to call to our family for the money.
And who are these people who tortured you or asked for money?
Those are the Bedouins in Egypt. There was one man who came like one day before us. When he saw the situation, was very shocked and fainted, and like in 3 days he died there. So it was very, very difficult and to talk about it. It's when you talk now, it seems like easy, but it is very, very terrible. I have never seen such kind of cruelty in my life. So I was lucky enough that I survived this.
Zabib left Eritrea in 2009 when she found out she had been put on a government blacklist for her social activism. In Tel Aviv, she runs the busy community center.
Women can come and feel safe, share their experiences, and talk to each other. We have a classes, English and Hebrew classes, tells them to be able to communicate outside, to ask what they want themselves, instead of dependent on other people to wait for translators. All activity for women are in the evening because most of them work during the day. During the day, it's a daycare. We have 20 kids here. You can see baby cribs.
And which ages are these children?
The oldest one is 2 years. The smallest one is 3 months.
And what is the situation? What are the circumstances of their parents?
Their parents are always cleaners. The kind of work we do here in Israel is cleaning.
So what's your life like now in Israel?
Life is very, very difficult in Israel for me. And first of all, we don't have permission to work in Israel. And because we don't have permission to work, we are exploited. Everybody uses us. We usually get like under minimum, very small money.
And what about the language that the politicians are using? You talk about people being infiltrators.
So when I came here in 2009, the situation in the neighborhood where I live was okay. Now they start to be violent against refugees because when the government or politicians use this word, they are infiltrators, they are a threat to our country. They came here to take over our jobs. They are not a refugee. So this is changing the mind of like people with whom we are living. So this is really influencing our life.
A baby is crying. Do you want to attend to him?
If you don't mind, yes.
Okay.
If you don't mind. Mom!
Is that your child?
Yes. I love him so much. My son, he's so cute. he makes me forget many irrelevant things. So I love him so much. Aaron.
How old is Aaron?
He's 2 years old.
Aaron is quite a common name in Israel. Do you want him to blend into Israeli society?
Well, he is in Israel. I don't want him to feel like isolated. I want him to be like the same person as everybody. But we don't have a birth certificate. We have a birth confirmation with no ID number and no nationality.
Why not?
We don't have any rights. We are not recognized refugees. He's not Israeli, not Eritrean, no ID. He's stateless.
This is Neve Shanan Street, the place most Africans find their friends, find the restaurants, find something to drink. The place where most asylum seekers have their shops.
Guiding me around the community is Oscar Oliver. He had to flee from the Democratic Republic of Congo when the authorities threatened to jail him because of his role in student politics. He now works with a charity called the African Refugee Development Center.
At my left, in the corner, this restaurant, a few years ago, something strange used to happen here. The suicide bombers used to come up to here and then blow themselves up. This is exactly the infiltrators, people who come in Israel with bombs, blow up and kill people. So when African refugees are referred to as infiltrators, this is particularly dangerous.
So lots of trinkets are being sold here, stores. It's almost like a typical African street.
Yeah, a lot of Africans, almost only Africans. I know a guy here, let's see if he's inside.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Who are you and what do you do?
I am Gabriel, I'm Eritrean, I'm living in Israel, I run also this shop. I have spices, especially is for Ethiopian, Eritrean, traditional clothes for especially the women they wear in marriage or the ceremony, the white one, or in like happy birthdays.
Any Israelis come in to buy anything?
There are some people, they start to use our food, but not in large number, very few. Yeah.
And what sort of papers do you have?
For me, I do have a paper for work. I'm one of the few people who have this privilege.
How are you so lucky? How did you get this privilege?
I'm one of the first comers. At the time, we were not large in number. And because of that, the government was willing to give us this paper. But after that, they stopped it and they changed everything. And other people who comes after 2008, from January 2008, they have different visas. Many people also, their visa is taken or being cancelled by the immigration authority.
So it's not a permanent work visa?
I have to renew it every 3 months, but I can work without any restriction in any place. Yeah.
You don't have fears it can be taken away from you?
Well, it could happen, because as far as there is no guarantee, I always live with fear it can be taken one day. Even the business that I have is illegal business. They can come and they can close it. I don't have any permit. I ask many times.
What about if they gave you $5,000 to go back home? Would you take it?
That's not the issue. Money does not bring us to here. We have a big political problem. Rather than giving us all this 5,000, If they help us change the system, we can't go without getting any money. So, like, you know, we are stuck in, like, in a limbo.
More customers. Let's leave you deal with the customers. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So what we as NGOs say is that the municipality should give them the permission to run legally their business and then pay taxes. By the way, you have in Israel up to 1,000 people who came from Eastern Europe who remained in the country after their visa expired, who came as a tourist. That means you have more illegal Europeans than Africans.
Very loud, very vibrant.
Yes. As you have noticed, it looks like a little Africa. So in some way, people do what they do in Africa.
Make
so,
noise.
So we want sometimes people to pay attention to the local culture and the local way of doing things in order not to attract the anger of the locals.
Isn't it understandable that there are tensions since there are so many Africans here?
Well, if you look at this place, yes, there are so many Africans here, yes. And the reason is that the two population, even if they live one close to the other, they live one away from the other. They almost have no contact. But also, we don't have much Africans in Israel. The reason is that all the Africans in Israel are put on the same place, on the same neighborhood. That's why you have the impression that there are a lot. If you walk 10 minutes away from this place, you go to North Tel Aviv, you won't see any African. You will have then the impression that there are no Africans in Israel. Israeli residents of this neighborhood, they are the weakest part of the society. That's why they have been put on top of them the whole weight of the asylum seekers.
What sort of jobs do the Israelis living here usually do?
Jobs done by local Israelis are not accessible to Africans. And the job done by Africans are the job that Israelis are not ready to do.
So here is a man pulling a trolley full of rubbish on it. And this is an African man who is pulling that trolley. Is that the type of job that you're talking about?
Yes. In terms of jobs, there's no competition. But there is a problem of the neighborhood being overcrowded. The people are too many in a small place.
You know what, there seems to be also a pungent smell around here.
Yeah, it's tough to keep the neighborhood clean.
So Oscar, tell me about yourself.
I am from the former Zaire, today Democratic Republic of Congo. And I've been in Israel for nearly 20 years. I came with a visa and a passport. Most asylum seekers came without a visa and passport, and they went through facility detention. All the NGOs in Israel, we came up saying that asylum seekers are not criminals, they got nothing to do in prison.
You came to seek asylum and you've been here for close to 20 years. What's your current status?
Well, the current status is quite confusing. I am between asylum seekers and a resident. My daughter, who was born here, has recently obtained citizenship. This should be extended to the whole family. We are working on it.
How long did it take for your daughter to get permission to stay?
10 years. 10 years. This is to bring to you how tough it is. Just imagine that someone who was born there takes 10 years to get a legal status. What then would happen to somebody who came 4 or 5 years ago without passport and without visa?
Oscar, Gabriel in his shop, and Zebib in the Eritrean Women's Center all talk about how hard life is for them in Israel and how they feel stuck in a legal limbo amid growing hostility from politicians and local residents. The government says it will not forcibly deport anyone. But at the beginning of 2014, the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, amended controversial legislation after the courts had ruled that the government could not detain asylum seekers for up to 3 years when they arrive in the country. The new law reduces that detention to 1 year, but it also adds that all asylum seekers can now be summoned to report to open detention facilities. Israeli NGOs are once again challenging the law in court,
and a ruling is expected in the next few months. But in the meantime, every month, a steady stream of buses make the two-hour journey south from Tel Aviv to the Holot detention facilities in the Negev Desert, taking people like Molo from Eritrea, who has been in Israel for 6 years.
Israel government, they said, if you want to go to Eritrea, you can go. But if you cannot go, to go to the jail, very bad situation. To give for person asylum seeker to give jail, it's very shameful, shame. Israelis, they cannot remember their histories. I'm not here terrorist or another thing, but I'm coming to protection.
I'm from Sudan, actually. I don't have to mention my name for several reasons. I came with my friend. He's already going to Holot. And so after 3 days, also I'm going to Holot. I have no any choice. I feel sad.
After this is gone.
You see now, my friend, he's so sad.
Ilana Stein, a deputy spokesperson for the Foreign Affairs Ministry, explains the government's thinking behind the changes to what it calls the Prevention of Infiltration Law.
The idea behind it is, of course, to deal with this problem of illegal immigrants. The idea is to stop this.
But in effect, the Israeli government has stopped this because your government has built a fence between Israel and Egypt, which means that there are no new arrivals from Africa.
Almost none of them, but still we still have to deal with the situation on the ground.
So why are you sending African asylum seekers to a detention facility in the middle of the desert?
Only 3,000 out of 56,000, and only for a few months or a year. We have two centers. One of them is the detention center called Holot, and the other one is called the Saharonim. In Saharonim, you can only have a person there up to a year, an illegal immigrant. And the other one, the detention center in Holot, is an open center, which means that they don't have to be there. They can come and go, and they just have to report a few times a day.
They can come and go, but they're in the middle of the desert.
Yes, that is true. They also came here illegally, you know.
But Israel has signed to protocols where you accept refugees.
They all received what is called collective protection because we couldn't send them back either to Sudan or to Eritrea. But the UN doesn't see this as a refugee status because refugee status can only be given individually. We've told them about a year ago that they can go to our Ministry of Interior and apply and show that they are really refugees and they are seeking for political protection from Israel. But only 1,800 of the refugees have done so. Only 2 out of 300 have received it. The other ones didn't qualify. I'll tell you even more than that. Whoever wants to leave the country to any other country in the world will be granted by the State of Israel $3,500. All they have to do is sign that they are leaving by their own will.
In other words, you're putting pressure on them to leave the country.
I think this is an incentive, not a pressure.
But these people largely come from Eritrea and Sudan, so yes. You're not sending these people back. It's like you acknowledge that where they come from is dangerous.
Yes, we definitely do. The UN stated that nobody should ever be sent back to Eritrea, and we abide to that. And with Sudan, I have to tell you, it's a different issue. According to the Sudanese law, a person who has visited to Israel cannot go back. If he goes back, he has to go to prison.
If you recognize that people cannot be sent back to Eritrea, and then at the same time you're saying that they don't qualify, then there must be something wrong with the criterion that is being used to judge people as not qualifying to become refugees.
The UN decided what are the criteria.
Why not allow them to work?
The police commissioner in Israel said that he thinks that the ones that are here should get working visas. This, of course, brought about a public debate, and it's still being discussed. This is a relative new problem for Israel, and it takes time to adjust to new situations, and this is what we're doing. So maybe in the future this was going to happen, but it takes time.
Israel never thought in terms of non-Jewish immigration. We never heard it until the 70s, because Israel was very poor, beleaguered with very fragile borders, and we didn't think that it would attract non-Jewish people to this country. So it doesn't have an immigration law, it doesn't have an immigration policy, it has signed the Refugee Convention, but the whole apparatus of deciding who merits asylum is very, very meager and cannot cope with the number of asylum seekers. And I think we share this with Australia, with Italy, and with England.
Amnon Rubinstein is a former government minister. He's now a professor of law. And a few years ago, he was appointed by the government to head a commission to examine issues of immigration, including African asylum seekers.
I advocate, first of all, giving them a training, being mechanics or plumbers or things that the country needs where there's employment. We have that status that you can work here without being a citizen. We can absorb them. I teach in a university where we have 7 students from Darfur, refugees. So not all of them have been relinquished by the government. Some of them have been absorbed into Israeli society. But even if they're not an asylum seeker, to whom can we send them? European countries and Australia and other countries chuck them back to their home countries. We cannot do that. Sudan is an enemy state.
What about the children who are born who, on their birth certificates, basically they don't have a nation that they belong to?
We've recommended 2 things. First of all, that anybody who stays in the country for over 10 years be entitled to Israeli citizenship. Secondly, the children should be given residence until they reach majority. When they stop being minors, they should make up their mind whether they want to stay here or not.
Is the lack of a policy something to do with what some politicians have argued, that it will change the nature of the Jewish state?
Absolutely. It looms over every issue. The fear that Israel would lose its Jewish majority would not be Israel. We have a very substantial Arab Muslim minority here, over 20% of the population. We have a non-Jewish immigration from the former Soviet Union, a very substantial one. We have guest workers coming temporarily and staying, overstaying their visa demands. If you go down the streets of Tel Aviv, you'll see people from all over the world.
That issue of Jewish identity is something I'll explore over the next half hour here on the BBC World Service when I meet people thought to be descendants of one of the so-called lost tribes of the ancient Israelites. Shira Shatto was 3 years old when she left Ethiopia, the land of her birth, to travel to the land of her religion.
The dream of Jerusalem and the dream of the Holy Land went through our DNA.
And I'll also be in the ancient walled city of Jerusalem to meet a little-known community with its roots in Africa.
Welcome to Africa.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The BBC World Service. You don't need a radio to listen to your favourite programmes from the BBC World Service. You can listen online to me, Matthew Bannister, on Outlook as I talk to people from around the world about their incredible experiences.
And if the world of money interests you, visit the Business Daily programme page and listen to me, Manuela Zaragoza, as we examine the big issues facing the global economy.
Or pick up your smartphone and listen to me, Claudia Hammond, because if you want to live a healthier life, we report on the latest medical breakthroughs and global health issues in Health Check.
And it's not just us. There are hundreds of programmes and documentaries to choose from in our archive.
Or you can listen to BBC World Service live online.
Make your choice at bbcworldservice.com.
This is the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Bachbinga and I've come to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to meet people from 3 different communities to explore their lives and experiences as Africans in the Holy Land. Join me after the news as I ask what it means for Ethiopian Jews to return to the land of their religion after generations away. Is it a dream fulfilled or not? And I meet the Afro-Palestinians in the old city of Jerusalem.
BBC News with David Austin. South Korean officials say it may take 2 months to properly search the ferry that sank on Wednesday. Hundreds of divers are working in dangerous conditions around the submerged vessel and have had problems getting inside. Just 3 bodies were recovered on Saturday, and more than 250 people remain unaccounted for. The headmistress of the Nigerian school from which over 100, mostly Christian schoolgirls, were abducted on Monday is asking the Nigerian authorities to do more to secure their release. She also pleaded with the kidnappers, believed to be the Islamist group Boko Haram, to have mercy on them. 28 civilians had been killed in a cattle raid in Warrap State in South Sudan. A local official said the police had killed three times as many attackers. It's not clear if there's any link with the ongoing civil war between the government and rebels loyal to the former vice president. One of Pakistan's best-known journalists, Hamid Mir, has been injured in an attack in Karachi. He was driving from the airport to his office when gunmen opened fire. Mr. Mir had recently told his family he'd received threats from Pakistan's main intelligence agency, the ISI, because of his views. Japan has begun construction work on a military radar station on an island off Taiwan in a move likely to anger China. The new base on Yanaguni is just 150 kilometres from Japanese-held islands claimed by China. The European Security Organisation, the OSCE, says it's sending its deputy head of mission to eastern Ukraine to help end the occupation of government buildings. The pro-Russian militants insist they'll only leave if Ukraine's interim leadership resigns. Two people have died in Saudi Arabia of the severe respiratory virus known as MERS, bringing to 76 the overall number of deaths in the kingdom. There's no known vaccine for MERS. BBC News.
Esther Rada is one of Israel's rising musical stars.
Found out that the monsters come at night, and I can't sleep, those busters came here to fight. It's not that
I'm Paul Bachibinga, and for Africans in the Holy Land here on the BBC, I meet Esther backstage at one of her concerts in Jerusalem.
Israel is It's a tough place to grow up in. You know, we have all the issues with the Arabs and the religion, and also because I am a daughter of immigrants from Ethiopia, that was also tough to be in a country full of white people and then black Jews coming. I was confused. I didn't know who I am. You know, I grew up and now I know. I'm a mix.
Her parents moved to Israel in 1984, in the first wave of flights organized by Israel, after religious authorities ruled that some Ethiopian Jews are descendants of ancient Israelites and therefore entitled to citizenship in the homeland set up for Jewish people. There are about 130,000 Ethiopian Jews in Israel. That's about 2% of the population. About half of them, including Esther, were born here.
Everyone got a piece of you, nothing left for me.
Esther grew up in an Israeli settlement close to the town of Hebron in the occupied West Bank.
And even though you act like you don't know, I can hear that fear.
Well, when I was young, it was a good place to be in. It's a small place, everybody knows everybody. Beside the fence that surround us and the soldiers. Okay, soldiers, tanks, bombs, yay, BP.
Wasn't it scary?
Well, only now when I look back at it, it was scary. But when I was young, you know, I didn't know anything else. So for me, that was reality.
What did your parents say? Did they...
They got scared.
They were scared?
They were scared. That's why we moved.
And did they feel that they had just been taken to that place?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. When they came to Israel, the government just put them there. So they didn't know. They wanted Israel. They didn't know, you know, what's good, what's not. They didn't know.
Don't you blame it on me.
So I was a religious child. We had to go to the synagogue every Saturday.
And growing up in a religious family and then choosing singing, was that easy?
My mother heard me a lot singing at home. So I think she knew where I'm going to. Well, music for me is God, and music for me is a religion, and it's a language, and it's love. So that's my religion, music.
Does your Ethiopian heritage play a role in your life?
Yes, of course. My whole family is very Ethiopian mentality, and they speak the language. I really like the culture and the real blood of Ethiopia.
And does that influence your music?
Yes, I did it on purpose, actually. Because when I was young, I didn't really wanted to speak the language or to hear the music because I was very confused at that time. And I was like, I said to my mom, don't talk to me in that language. If you want to speak to me, talk to me in Hebrew. When I grow up and I realized I cannot run away from my roots and my family, I started to listen to the music again and I fell in love.
My name is Shira Shato. I'm married to Shlomi Asulim and a mother to two kids. I immigrated to Israel when I was 3 years old. Like all the others that came in that time, I'm talking about the first move of immigration to Israel. It was between 1977 to 1985. We did a journey from Ethiopia through Sudan to Israel. And now I'm a student in Mandel Leadership Institution. The aim is to invest in people who want to make change in the education and social field. My aim is to build a heritage institution for the Ethiopian community.
What do you hope to achieve?
I want that there will be more knowledge about the Ethiopian community. The Israeli society think of us as unprivileged people, poor society that come from the third world, doesn't have anything to contribute to the Israeli society. And not just that, it's also a society that inquire a lot of governmental help. And also I think that we adopt this kind of thinking, and a lot of us, a lot of kids start to think that maybe they are not good enough. And I want to change this kind of thinking inside and outside the community.
Now, the last official airlift of Ethiopians, mm-hmm. Ethiopian Jews into Israel happened in August 2013. And what advice would you give to the young children who have now come into Israel?
I will say to the parents, be involved in the life of your kids, to understand that although they don't know Hebrew, they have a lot of knowledge that they should give to their kids. In our family, it was very clear that although I went with my parents to translate them everywhere because they didn't speak the language, it was very clear who is the parents and who is the child.
But in other cases, does it change?
Yeah, I think that kids became those who know and those who lead the families, and it's a problem because kids, they still need their parents to be their parents, and it's also an impact on their identity because they see their parents as a weak parents that can't contribute to them, that can't help them, and sometimes they're willing to just delete their Ethiopian identity, although it's impossible because you can identify it right away. So it's create a lot of, you know, inside tension. Shlomi,
they are coming.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, who's this?
Hello.
Hi.
Shalom.
Itamar. So this is your husband and
yeah.
Your kids.
The kids, Itamar. He said that he's a little bit shy.
He's shy.
Oh,
yeah.
הנה האורחים שלנו.
כן, הנה, לא קוראים פול.
הלו.
ואם לא אורחים.
הם לא אורחים, אז מה הם?
הם עם נטע ועם יאיך.
He gave you a new name.
Well, what,
he said okay. That you are not guest and he know your name, so he gave you a new name.
Oh, really? I'm glad a guest. So what do you do?
Actually, I'm an architect, but we build a building. But first of all, I believe that we need to build a family.
So how did you guys meet?
We actually work in this neighborhood. We were six students who tried to change the world. Not so far from here, we had a learning center. We had a youth group that Shlomi lead. He saw me and he fell in love immediately.
I'm sure it wasn't difficult.
Actually, before we meet each other, we study in the Hebrew University in the political science department. So I saw her, and that's it. I knew in one day that we will marry together.
Did it matter that you came from different backgrounds?
Well, that she's from Ethiopia and I'm an Israeli guy.
I'm also Israeli, you know?
So my parents originally from Morocco. Morocco, it's north of Africa. So for me, it's simple. I didn't deal with this idea that she's from Ethiopia, she's a black woman.
Shira, was it an issue for you?
For me, not, but people keep asking, and how the family of Shlomi deal with the fact that you are black, and I keep asking, and how my family deal with the fact that he's not Ethiopian, because it's also an issue in the Ethiopian community, but people assume that my family will be glad and the issue will be with Shlomi family.
Two lovely children, what are your dreams for them?
I dream that they will know their heritage, both heritage of my family and also Shlomi's family, and they will understand that the diversity that exists in Israel is a good thing.
Have you made any trips to Ethiopia and Morocco?
We've been in Ethiopia almost 3 years ago, and we're planning to go to Morocco.
What was it like going back to Ethiopia?
It was incredible trip because I speak the language, you know, not fluently, but I speak very well and I understand. And I was very close to the people. They felt comfortable to talk with me and they were very proud of me. So it was very nice. And also they share a lot of stories. And so it was like I go back to, you know, a big family. I don't know how to call it.
Have you been to Morocco before?
Never, but I always traveling in Morocco in my mind, yes.
Why try to go back to your roots? Why not say, we've cut off being Ethiopian, we've cut off being Moroccan, and we're just Israeli?
Our parents and our grandparents leave their places after thousands of years that they live there, yes? They made for us a very, very big step. They came to Israel. And when they came to Israel, it was a very big conflict for them because it was a different culture. It was the Israeli, the Zionism idea. It was based on European people.
By European people?
By European people, yes. And I think that...
Damaged by...
They
came to... Yeah, they were hard by this situation deeply. They didn't use their culture and they didn't can speak the language free. The Arab language, it was, you know, belonged to the enemy.
So did they face discrimination?
Yes, of course. We still know that there is a discrimination. And about Ethiopian people, and about Jewish that come from Arab countries. We need to try to fix this situation. In our roots, in the Jewish Arab people, there is a lot of tolerance, there is a lot of there is a lot of values. Though these values can help the Israeli society.
We should influence and we should make the Israeli society deeper and build up from the different cultures that we are coming from. Because I think that's the beauty and that's the gift that we can give, each one of us, to this society in order to enrich it.
I'm Paul Bachibinga of the BBC and I'm now in Jerusalem's Old City to find out more about a group of people who are Palestinian but have their roots in Africa.
My name is Mahmoud Jidda Salamat. I'm from the old city of Jerusalem, but originally from Chad. My father came pilgrimage here and he settled in Jerusalem at the beginning of the 20th century.
And you were born here?
Yes, I was born here during the war of 1948, and we were kicked out of the city from there to Jordan.
So we have something in common. Both our fathers were born in Africa.
Yes.
I'm from Uganda.
You are from Uganda? Oh, yes. The organization I belong at that time, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. At that time they hijacked a plane and they went to Uganda in 1972, something like that, you know.
76. So that was when there was an Air France plane that was captured by the Popular Front and taken to Entebbe. And there was an Israeli raid on Entebbe?
Yes, and they killed many people.
And your friend was killed as well?
Yeah, my friend at that time.
So your friend was with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which you were a member of. Did you meet any consequences as a result of being a member of that group?
So I was imprisoned in 1968. And I was sentenced to 25 years. I was released later on prisoner exchange, exactly on 20th of May 1985.
And how was your experience in prison?
My experience in prison, it's great.
Great?
Yeah. What I feel proud of, I went out of prison more human than before. It was an opportunity for me to read many things. So I found out we are all human beings. There is no justification for shooting and killing each other. Why for? And I feel myself free, open-minded, and that feeling, I couldn't feel it before.
Stop. Your fan wants to greet you. You seem to be a popular person here. Who is this? Is this your niece?
Daughter.
Your daughter. Hi, how are you doing? What's your name?
Tujan.
Tujan. What does Tujan mean?
The flower.
The flower, oh yes.
So she's one of wonderful ladies in the city.
Your daughter has run away. So where are we now, Mahmoud?
Now we are at the entrance of the old city of Jerusalem, which is called Damascus Gate, which is the famous gate of Jerusalem.
Damascus Gate. And it's quite impressive with, I can see two towers.
Yeah.
Sandstone color that is very popular around Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And who lives in the city?
36,000 people. They're from all over the world. Now, the old city now traditionally is divided in four quarters. We have the Muslim quarter and the Christian quarter, the Armenian quarter, and the Jewish quarter. And the roads are really very tiny.
The narrow roads, plus the steps as well.
Plus the steps, because Jerusalem is built over top hills, you know. So wherever you move, you should go steps. And we don't have transportation in the city here. That's why it has a big problem for sick people or needy people or handicapped people. It's really very difficult for them to live in the city here.
In fact, how big is this old city?
It's less than 1 square kilometer. At the same time, so small, but it is the biggest problem in the whole world. Why? Because, for example, you have 3 main religions. Everybody is fighting for this city.
So when did the Africans come to Old Jerusalem?
The Africans in Jerusalem here are from a long, long time ago. I can say from the beginning of the Islam period. But if I'm talking about the people I'm living among them, they are new. I can say toward the end of 19th and beginning of 20th century.
And what did they come to do?
One, they come to religious. Because as Muslims, when you go to visit Mecca and Medina, it's good. But if you come to Jerusalem, it's much better.
And bang on cue, there's a call for prayer.
Once again, the call for prayer.
Then the other reason?
The other reason is they came to support the Palestinians against the occupation. And I remember some of them were soldiers with the British Army. So they came here and found themselves fighting against Palestinians, against Arabs, against Muslims. So they didn't accept that. So they left the army and joined the Palestinians here.
So originally they came as part of the British mandate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Will you be going for prayers?
For me personally, no. I don't pray usually. But I respect religion.
So, some Africans settled in Jerusalem's old city centuries ago as pilgrims. Others came during the days of the British Mandate for Palestine, between the 1920s and 1948, when the modern state of Israel was created.
لا انا حرام كيف شحرتيني.
Mahmoud's father came to Jerusalem on pilgrimage and stayed to be close to one of Islam's holiest sites, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mahmoud and I are now just round the corner from its silver dome. On either side of a narrow alleyway, there are two stone arches, and tucked away behind them is a cluster of stone dwellings.
Welcome to Africa.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is a historical building. It was built by the Mamluks in 1192. This place in Arabic is called Ribat.
Ribat.
Ribat. Ribat in the early age of Islam used to be a military post. So later on, when peace prevailed in the area, the role of Ribat changed from military to civil.
Okay.
And used to host poor people who want to stay to worship God. They have no place to go, they can stay here. And then later on, the Ottomans came here. They turned this place into prisons. The Africans began to settle here in 1930s, in these two places. My father and my cousins and my uncles, and most of them were working to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque, to guard it, to clean it.
So the Africans didn't come as slaves?
No. All the Africans here are not slaves.
So which countries did the Africans come from?
Chad, Nigeria, Senegal, and Sudan. They are living here in these two both places as one family. Because all of them are Muslims.
And your father came from?
My father came from Chad. My mother, she's Jordanian. Imagine, my father African, my mother Jordanian, I'm Palestinian. And then you get in a small corridor here. Now you have another gate. Now this gate leads you to an open yard. Come. As you see here. This is the place where I was brought up. Here. All my childhood was here.
It's lovely. It looks lovely.
It looks lovely, but if you go back at the time when I was living in here, maybe you won't see that. We had one room only, which is 7.5 square meters, and we had 8 people living in that room. My father, my mother, and we are 6 brothers and sisters living in one single room. That's it.
The whole family?
Whole family. And the same our neighbors. So I can't stay here. So now me and my brother left. Imagine in the morning we have only one toilet here.
Now are there many more toilets around?
Yeah, in each house now we have a toilet. Imagine we turn the toilet into a house now. Why? Because people want to stay in Jerusalem. If you get outside the boundary of Jerusalem, you lose your right to stay in Jerusalem. That's why people try to stay in very bad condition rather than lose their right to stay in Jerusalem. Imagine that. But you should know also, although it was a very bad condition here, very poor people, but we are very happy. This is our original house, that one. Now only my sister is still living in here.
Are we allowed? Can we get in?
Yeah, for sure.
Who are we? And who is this?
This is my nephew.
Your nephew? Oh. Hello, assalamu alaikum. How are you? My name is Paul.
Nader.
Yours Nader?
Yeah.
What do you do?
I work like in a reception, like in King David Hotel.
That big posh hotel? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Obama is big right there.
Obama stayed there. Yeah. But you enjoy your work?
Yeah, it's good. Meet like big people, like Barcelona team, football.
The Barcelona team
came?
Yeah.
Messi, Iniesta, Piqué.
Did you get their autographs?
No, I can't talk to
them. You are not allowed to talk to them. So you've lived here all your life?
We got like 3 generations right here in African Quarter. My grandfather from Africa.
And where was your grandfather from?
Chad. Chad.
Do you ever wish sometimes to go and check out Chad?
I hope to go there, see how it's different. To tell them like we got like African Quarter like in all city in Jerusalem.
There are different quarters: Armenian, Christian, Jewish. Do you have friends from across those various quarters?
Christian Quarter, Muslim Quarter.
But not in the
Jewish Quarter.
Jewish Quarter, you don't have friends.
No.
Why not?
Arab and Jewish. Right here, we can make like friends. Yeah.
You sound American.
Me? I know a lot of people from America. I be going like in school for American people. Yeah.
That's why you picked up the accent. Hey, glad to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Do you miss living in the old city?
Yes. I wish one day I can come back to the old city.
Thank you so much for sharing.
I'm
Paul Bachibinga. My journey to the Holy Land has come to an end, and it's been a fascinating experience hearing the tales and history of my fellow Africans. But of course, the journey goes on with all its highs and all its lows for the people we have met here on the BBC. I asked Sabib from Eritrea whether she wanted to expand the family.
We have one baby. I don't think we'll... I don't know, because I have experienced a very bad racism in the hospital when I gave birth to him. At that time, I don't understand Hebrew. I was only speaking English. If I asked her, she refused to answer me. She doesn't want to speak to me. And she left me alone in the delivery room, and she went out. While the baby was coming out, I told her, he wants to come out. I have to push, but she said no.
So it wasn't a joyful moment when you gave birth to Aaron?
No. It was like... I felt very sad.
Shira came to Israel from Ethiopia when she was only 3.
The dream of Jerusalem and the dream of the Holy Land went through our DNA. But we are in Jerusalem, but we didn't fulfill the dream yet, because I think that until we will feel at home and until we will be part of this society, you know, this is my place also, and I should feel at home and I should be the owner of this place. Not in the physical, but more in the cultural and the spiritual ways. We are physically here, but we didn't fulfill the dream yet.
And Oscar from the Democratic Republic of Congo, after 20 years in Israel, is still without refugee status. Nevertheless, he's found a home in the Holy Land.
We going to a place where I'm going every Shabbat.
I am Mira Raz. I'm a rabbi. Of course, in our congregation, what can I say? His color is different. But for us, it doesn't make any difference to us. Not his color of his skin, and not the religion he comes from, because, of course, he's not Jewish. And I know that God, the God of everyone, not the God only God of the Jews, will give him a gold medal for what he's doing in the world. I'm honored that he comes to our services.
Yes, I'm coming here for the Kabbalah Shabbat. There is a light, there is something special, there's something new, by the way.
You seem to be at home.
Yes, yeah, that's it.
The producer of Africans in the Holy Land is Penny Dale.